Hi, I'm Jennifer Wilde, and you're listening to Sober Exposure. If it's about recovery, we're gonna cover it. It's like one big therapy session, but it's free. So thanks for joining our dysfunctional family as we uncover recovery with Sober Exposure. Let's go. It's One of a Mind podcast with me, Jennifer Wilde, and very excited to bring you this episode. It's very exciting because this podcast is actually a spinoff for those of you that are just joining this podcast of a podcast called Sober Exposure. So I am very candid about the fact that I struggle with substance abuse disorder. I have my whole life, and it's caused just a little bit of aggravation in my life, just a tiny bit. So without further ado, I brought in Dr. Fingerhood. Welcome to the show. And Dr. Fingerhood is affiliated with ASAM. And he's going to tell us what it stands for, even though I know, and what it's all about. Because when I found you guys, I was like, thank the Lord. So welcome.
So thank you for having me. So again, I'm Mike Fingerhood. I've been an academic position for a long time, really trying to champion taking care of people with addiction. And that's what so ASAM is the American Society of Addiction Medicine. It's the largest physician organization that takes that initially was only physicians, but now has other healthcare providers. And our mission really is to help and represent people who often don't have a voice, so people with addiction. A lot of providers or physicians within ASAM, or Addiction Medicine, do have some lived experience with addiction themselves. But now it's really expanded into a group of healthcare providers who want to scientifically, with evidence, take care of people with addiction, take away stigma, and say this is a chronic disease like any other, and we have to stop siloing it and stigmatizing.
I want to cry. I love you so much. I do, you know, because we've been through so much as addicts. I've been turned down from jobs over the years, careers, because you Google me and I'm an addict. I have been in jail. I'm proud of it. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, so thank you so much for that. Now, a couple questions. When you say substance abuse disorder, what is substance abuse disorder and how do you diagnose it?
Okay. First question. So most of this is just going to be me speaking, but I wanted to make sure I got the nomenclature correctly. So as you know, so it's the American Society of Addiction Medicine, and the term substance use disorders is really in something, in a book called the DSM. And it's so we use the term addiction within the society. And the definition within the society has changed and evolved. And I think you'll like the most recent definition, which was in 2019. And I'm gonna state it. It may sound mundane.
Please say it, please.
Yeah. So addiction is a treatable chronic medical disease involving complex interactions among brain circuits, genetics, the environment, and individual life experiences. Prevention efforts and treatment approaches for addiction are generally as successful as those for other chronic diseases.
Interesting, because other people say, oh no, what, I think 7% they say, maybe 5, so.
Yeah, and I think the message here is that as a society, we try to give hope, right? So I remember when I was a medical student, I was in the Bronx, and I admitted a lot of patients with injection drug use. And it didn't seem that we ever addressed it. We would address complications of injection drug use. But I said to my faculty member, you know, someone much older than me, why don't we address that? And his answer was addiction isn't something that we can, that as physicians, we can have an answer to. And obviously that my career has been, and ASAM's goal is to say that that is incorrect, that we have to deal with it as just like any other medical illness. And it's very treatable.
Very. I like how you put "very" before that. Very treatable. And what's so interesting is please don't be insulted because this obviously excludes you. But for the most part, anyone that struggles with what I struggle with, we feel like doctors don't really understand what we have. Doctors don't understand. They have no, like, very little understanding of what this deal is all about. Do you agree?
Yeah. So I think that I think unfortunately you're correct. And so a lot of what we do with an ASAM, I teach a lot of courses with it for ASAM as well. We have a lot of webinars, is really getting people to understand that this is treatable. And the frustration is the fault of many medical providers in viewing it in a different way. If I ask the physician, when you take care of someone with diabetes who needs to lose weight, do you say they're a failure when their weight is the same when they come back, or if their glucose isn't as well controlled as you want it?
Right.
To be?
Yeah. You are such a disappointment. Look at your glucose level. Yes. Right. Yeah.
Right. We don't say that. Right. And we understand that people, none of us always eat as well as we should. None of us exercise as well. And so for me, it's been one of the most gratifying thing I've done. That's why I've been doing it for over 35 years, is because it's so gratifying to work with people. It's time intensive, but the reward is really great. You probably know firsthand that I really get to know patients better than, they know me. We know each other better than perhaps they know anybody else.
I love that, because it's not a one size fits all situation. I mean, what is going to work for one person is not going to work for the other person, I believe. So that's great.
Yeah, so that's correct. I mean, I, again, to follow what you just said, that the whole goal of treatment is being person-centered. So I see patients in a hospital setting who unfortunately have a complication, or outpatient setting, and I give them choices. I try to understand what would work best for them. And I, again, an analogy would be that there's lots of illnesses. We have choices. If I have someone with high blood pressure, I can choose among many different medications. But I try to see what would fit into the person's lifestyle, understand, side effects, how easy it would be. So it really just means being person-centered.
So when you say that you treat, so what do you use for, how do we treat it? What do you do? How do you do it? Is it conventional? Is it, we know it's not one size fits all, but what does it look like?
Yeah. So, examples, in the settings I have, probably if you looked at the most common is treating opioid use disorder, which has been really devastating with fentanyl in this country and opioid overdose epidemic.
It's killing everybody.
So for opioids, we know for sure that medications save lives. I have a bumper sticker right here, medications save lives. I went for a run the other day. I saw it on a car. I thought, oh, I want to know who owns that car. Because medication saves lives is one of the important bumper stickers for microdose addiction medicine.
I love it.
Yeah, so we have choices of medications. Generally for opioid use disorder, it's methadone versus buprenorphine. And again, I don't tell the person what to choose. I inform them the good parts, the bad parts, why it would help. And the same would be true for alcohol use disorder as well, that we have medications, we have supportive therapy. And we come
naltrexone.
Naltrexone.
Okay, so here's the big pink elephant in the room. And I'm going to go there. I don't know. I talked to your assistant before. I don't know. She said, be careful about your terminology and all that. But what she doesn't know is I'm Jen Wild. And I don't know how much you know about rock and roll music. But when I interviewed Dave Grohl, who used to be in the band Nirvana, they said, do not bring up Nirvana. He's trying to identify himself as his own. So don't. First thing I said in the interview, Dave, how you doing? You must be going through a really hard time since Kurt Cobain died. And, first thing, so I am going to go there. And what I'm going to say, the pink elephant in the room, is there's a very old school, and this also saves lives, but there's some old school thinking, okay, ways of recovering, which is great. I got kicked out of that because I'm on Suboxone. Okay. Now I'm on Suboxone because it's worked for me. It's working for me. I don't plan on being it the rest of my life, but if I am, I don't give a shit. I don't care because I'm alive. I'm not high. Do I look like I'm high?
No.
Am I slurring my words? Am I acting like I'm, you know? So a lot of people like to judge and say that I'm not in recovery. I haven't recovered because I choose Suboxone over death. Now, one more thing, and I'm going to give you the floor back. I will tell you that my son, who is 17, had a friend who died from fentanyl, didn't know he was taking fentanyl, and he's dead. When I was talking to her mother, she said, I just wish that I would have known about Suboxone or any of these, you know, medicines that can manage this larger than life affliction that my son has. He'd still be alive. So, all right, let's go, doctor.
Okay. So there's going to be a long answer. So first, I have to say, when I first started doing this, I wasn't able to prescribe Suboxone or buprenorphine. And I felt very helpless. My patients could only, the only choice for medication was methadone. Some patients didn't want to go to a methadone program, which unfortunately has its own stigma and continues. Mm-hmm. So when buprenorphine or Suboxone became available, now I'm a primary care physician, and we now have over 600 patients receiving integrated primary care for treatment for opioid use disorder with Suboxone buprenorphine. Now, so we refer to both buprenorphine and methadone as medication for opioid use disorder or medication and addiction treatment. And we need to get away from the term medication-assisted treatment because the medication is treatment. And we don't say that about anything else. When someone is diabetic and they're on medication, because we don't say that they didn't lose weight, so they're now on medication-assisted therapy. So that itself is stigmatizing to medication. Now, having said that, if you go to 12-step meetings, which you probably have at Narcotics Anonymous, they'll say what you said. If you're on medication, you're not in recovery. So it's interesting because Alcoholics Anonymous, or AA, for decades has said that if a healthcare provider prescribes something to you, that you can take it.
In the big book, it says that. Yes.
But somehow Narcotics Anonymous historically did not accept that. I think it's changing, and I hope it is. Mm-mm. And the other aspect, which you mentioned, is recovery. And so I always have a discussion of recovery with patients. Recovery isn't based on medication, not medication. So the definition that I offer patients, which I think is important enough, is that recovery means that you're trying to make today better than yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, I love it. I am in recovery because you know what? I'm trying to make today better than yesterday.
That's exactly what I tell patients.
And, easy.
And even if I see somebody, you know, who had used the day before and they're coming to see me for help, I say, guess what? You're now in recovery. You asked me for help. That means today's better than yesterday.
Man, I love it. There's so many people that need to find this way. You know, it's you should not have a whip. You shouldn't be whipped for having this thing. Now, do you believe that it is a disease? Do we say disease these days or no? Or
we use that mostly because it can take away blame. And, you know, the terms don't often matter, but it can take away the blame. And part of the hangup sometimes with 12-step meetings, which is also a disease, is that whether or not someone is helpless. And I think that you need help, but you're not helpless, right? Because you could take the steps and do the things that you need to achieve some recovery.
Oh yeah, definitely not helpless.
I should say powerless.
I'm not powerless either.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I'm not. And I was brainwashed that I was because I walked into my first AA meeting when I was 16. So hence, I had a lot of that in me. So I do have a very militant attitude when it comes to this, like you have to do it this way or you're never going to be successful. Cause that's the way that I was taught and raised in growing up in this thing called wellness or recovery.
Yeah.
So yeah, it did a number on me. I'm telling you, would you say somebody should do if they find themselves feeling like they're not in control of using. Where do they go?
But I think you want to get help. So within ASAM, we have, you know, physicians within ASAM could be certified in addiction medicine. And that's a big thing that's happened over the past decade is the recognition that addiction medicine is a field that is rigorous. You have to pass a certifying exam. And people who are certified in addiction medicine are like-minded in realizing that we don't stigmatize people with addiction, that we offer hope, that we offer treatment, and that individuals should seek out effective treatment, especially medications, which unfortunately have been stigmatized, including by some of the industry of addiction treatment.
Well, yeah, I would say that, unfortunately, I this is such a gray area to talk about, but I feel like they're the proprietors pretty much, you know, so.
Yeah, I think we have to be careful because the standard model of, unfortunately, addiction treatment for many years was go somewhere for 30 days and then you'll be good.
Yeah, sure. A lifetime of abusing yourself physically, mentally, emotionally, in every way, shape. And just sure. Yeah. Yeah. Just sit, please. It takes 30 days for me to just start getting all the cobwebs out of my brain, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, it's unreal. So I all I have to say is I'm very grateful that the world is waking up to this and understanding that one size doesn't fit all. And there's a million, what's going to work for me may not work for you. You know? Yeah. But you said it's very, very treatable. So that gives me and a lot of people hope. So my next question is, I know that there's a lot of research about more medications, more things that can help put a stop to the stigma. No, I'm just kidding. There's no pill that's ever going to put a stop to the stigma. But is there any advancements in treatment?
Yeah. So I think we're getting there. So first I'll say for opioid use disorder, you know, we mentioned buprenorphine and methadone. We're looking at more ways to reach people. We're looking more at long acting, for instance, injectable buprenorphine that can last 30 days. Some of the work that I've been doing is looking at, you know, touch points, which means initiating treatment in as many places as you can, meaning emergency departments. We're looking at EMS, so if someone has an overdose, being able to offer treatment at the point, perhaps having a peer recovery coach show up at the site of an overdose and say, hey, let's get you started in some treatment. Mm-hmm. And for alcohol use disorder, I think that we're looking for more medications that help, especially binge drinking as well as more severe alcohol use disorder.
What about the naltrexone?
Yeah, so naltrexone is something that we use for craving. And there was just a paper published on naltrexone about a week ago looking at episodic use of naltrexone for people who, for instance, binge drink, that episodically taking naltrexone may actually prevent someone from having 5, 6, 7, 8 drinks and instead only have 2 or 3.
Yes, exactly. It's all, listen, it's harm control, right?
That's correct.
You know, I mean, what's better? Me taking, and so now correct me if I'm wrong, but naltrexone, I know, I thought naltrexone, if you take it, you don't get any kind of buzz or it does, you're not affected by the alcohol, but you could still drink and you don't get sick. That's the difference between that and an abuse, correct?
Correct. So you don't get sick, but you could still feel the effects of naltrexone.
Oh, you can. Okay.
Drink as much. So your craving will go away. So that's correct.
Is there naltrexone in Suboxone? Cause I have found that, cause I can't handle my alcohol at all. Nobody wants to be around me when I'm drinking. But I found that since I've been on Suboxone, my alcohol craving's gone.
So that's interesting because you're not the first person who's told me that. So,
really?
Suboxone has both buprenorphine and naloxone in it. You know, it's put under the tongue. The reason it was made in that preparation was to try to prevent people from injecting the buprenorphine part, which happened in France and in Europe prior to approval here. But having said that, there is some absorption of the naloxone in the sublingual tablet. And so it's totally possible, and I've heard this from multiple patients, that their craving for alcohol diminished when they were on Suboxone.
I mean, it's unreal. Like I've had periods where I hadn't drank for years, but I was always fighting it, you know, or yeah. I'd be at a restaurant and I was like, you know, and I was angry and pissed. I could be at a friggin' rock concert in the front row with the craziest rock and roll band where I'd want to usually get totally enamored. I wouldn't even think of a drink. All since the Suboxone. So yeah, it's great. There's so many great things happening. And tell us where we can find you and your website. And I know that also if you want to have a voice and advocate or volunteer, if you feel the same way I feel, how could we find you and how could we find how to volunteer and use our voice?
I think
to break the stigma.
You know, I'm speaking today on behalf of ASAM, and ASAM has a lot of information on its website. So that's probably the best place to go, which is asam.org. And there's a lot of ways. So for instance, I'm at Johns Hopkins, we have an anti-stigma campaign that's called Words Matter. So you can find it there as well, where people can sign up to know what words to use and that we should all be careful in the language and the way we say things. ASAM has been a really big proponent organization speaking out for patients. We're looking even more so to have voices of people with lived experience like yourself.
Like me. I'm going to sign up. I'm going to do everything I can because it's a no-brainer. You guys are doing exactly what I've been screaming and yelling about.
Yeah. I just want to give a plug. We have an annual meeting, and at the annual meeting, we really try to do more in terms of being skill-based, motivational interviewing, teaching young providers how to provide motivational interviewing and not be, tell people what to do, but to work to be open and patient-centered. And we actually have two movie nights this year as well. And one of the movie nights is about women lost in the opioid crisis that I'm actually in the film with Deborah Goncharovnik. So we're really looking for sensitive ways to humanize how addiction is viewed.
Thank you so much for all that work, really. Thank you so much. What is the name of the film that you're in?
So it's Attention Must Be Paid, Women Lost in the Opioid Crisis is the name of the film.
And where is it? So, is it released already? Is it Netflix?
It's going to be 1 hour version at the conference, but it's going to be on ABC affiliates as well as beginning next year on PBS.
Great. You're doing such amazing things. I'm so glad that you and I met because I want to have you back. I do. I want to talk some more. I really would like to talk some more. Reach out to ASAM. I was calling it ASAM. It's ASAM. That's
ASAM is easier to say.
It is easier to say, especially when you have a brain like me. It's ASA, SAT, ASA. I can't get any of these letters right. So anyway, ASAM, ASAM. Thank you so much. I am going to see more of you because I'm really excited about this.
Perfect. Thank you, Jen.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And this is One of a Mind podcast because we are all one of a kind, right? Thank you. Have a great week, everybody. Need more? Of course you do. The show's all about needing more. Go to my website at soberexposure.show or get stuck on my Instagram at soberexposure_podcast.